Thank you, Dr. Ava. Good afternoon to you, brethren. It is one of the lowest lying bodies of water on Earth, sitting about 680 feet below sea level. It is known by several names, and in the Old Testament, the name of it was the Sea of Chinnereth. Later, it was called the Lake of Gennesaret. The Hebrew name for it is Yam Kinneret, which means, or derived from the word kinar, which means harp or lyre or harp-shaped, while other sources say it is pear-shaped or even heart-shaped, H-E-A-R-T. The Arabic name for it is Buharat Tabariye, which means Lake Tiberias. We know it today as the Sea of Galilee, and the Jordan River flows right through it. It's a relatively small lake with a surface area of 64 square miles and 12 and a half miles long, 4 to 7.5 miles wide, depending on where you cross. Its depth is 80 to 150 feet deep, which makes it a relatively shallow lake by comparison to the world's deepest lakes, which range from anywhere from 1,500 to 5,000 feet. Crater Lake in America is the deepest U.S. lake, and it's about 2,000 feet deep. It is surrounded, the Sea of Galilee is surrounded by hills, especially on the east side, where they reach 2,000 feet. The heights are a source of cool, dry air. In contrast, directly around the sea, the climate is semi-tropical, with warm, moist air. The large difference in the height and the surrounding land and the sea causes temperature and pressure changes rapidly. This results in a strong wind can be dropping to the sea, funneling through the hills. Since the Sea of Galilee is a small body of water, these winds descend directly to the center of the lake with violent results. When contrasting air masses meet, a storm can rise quickly and without warning. Since it is only 150 feet deep at its greatest depth, a shallow lake can be whipped up where the energy would be absorbed in a deeper lake. And because the Sea of Galilee is below sea level, we said 680 feet, and is surrounded by these mountains, creating these downdrafts over the lake combined with a thunderstorm that appears suddenly over the surrounding mountains, the water over the lake can stir up rapidly and produce 20-foot waves. The sea can be calm 1 minute and violent the next. Interestingly, these storms usually do not happen at night. I say usually. With these facts in mind, brethren, let's look at a very familiar story to us that is found in Matthew 8. In Matthew 8. Matthew chapter 8. In Matthew 8, in the beginning of Matthew 8, Matthew describes the healing of a leper in verses 1 through 4. Then in verses 5 through 13, he describes the healing of the centurion's servant. And in verses 14 through 15, the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. And we'll pick it up in verse 16 with the healing of many after the Sabbath sunset. Verse 16. Verse 16 says, when evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with the word and healed all who were sick. And skipping on down to verse 18, it says, now when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. And skipping down to verse 23, it says, now when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, but he fell asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing. In verse 26, he says, but he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? And then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. In verse 27, and the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him? Because of the great multitudes that were gathering together, Christ commands the disciples to cross the lake, to escape the crowds. And verse 23, Christ got into a boat, it says. The word for boat is plion, P-L-O-I-O-N, which means vessel, ship, or boat. And Jesus himself was not a fisherman, but he used fishing boats both as a means of transportation and also for the preaching to the crowds. The most of these boats belonged to fishermen like Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and Zebedee, James and John's father. But what did these boats look like? Now, this particular boat had to be big enough to be able to hold 13 people. The Bible gives us a detailed description of Noah's Ark, but there's no such description for the fishing boats that were used or written about in the New Testament. However, in 1985, a first century fishing boat was discovered in the mud along the shore of the Sea of Galilee. And it was discovered by two brothers who were fishermen and amateur archaeologists. The remains of the boat were preserved and is now in the Yigal Allen Museum by the Sea of Galilee. It is called the Ancient Galilee Boat. Some people even refer to it as the Jesus Boat. According to the museum, the boat was 27 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and 4.5 feet deep. It had a crew of five. The boat was rowable with four staggered rowers and one to steer and supervise the catch. The boat could carry about 0.5 ton of fish. It also had a mast, and this particular boat had a mast to be able to sail the boat. The supervisor also had to keep a close eye on the weather, because as we mentioned before, because storms that could quickly pop up and develop over the sea. And this boat was large enough to be able to hold about 15 people. In verse 24, we see that there was a tempest or a great whirlwind, like a hurricane. And Mark calls it a great storm of wind causing waves that covered the boat. They thought they were going to die. And all through all of this, Christ was sleeping in the back of the boat. Remember, they left sometime after sunset. And depending on where they crossed, it took anywhere from a little less than an hour up to 2 hours to cross. So it would have been at night. And most storms on the Sea of Galilee take place in the daytime. Now, some commentaries say that this storm may have been at the hand of God to prove, or giving proof of the deity of Jesus Christ, because he rebuked the winds and the sea, and they obeyed his voice. Another incident that took place on the Sea of Galilee is very familiar to us, brethren, including or involving the disciples, is found in Matthew 14. Let's take a look at that in Matthew 14. Verse 22. In Matthew 14, verse 22, it says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. And when evening had come, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the lake, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." They cried out for fear. They cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt?" And when they had gone into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This time the disciples went into the boat alone. And Jesus went up into the mountains to pray. Jesus Christ often went out to the mountain to pray, and he would pray all night or at length. He often did this before an important event was going to take place. We'll see a little bit later. He was up there till evening time, it says. The storm was tossing the disciples around for quite some time. John's account of the story says they had only gone 3 or 4 miles out. And it's only 7.5 miles wide at its widest point. Jesus was walking on the water when they saw him 3 or 4 miles out. He came to them in the fourth watch, it says, which is between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. in verse 25. If it only takes 2 hours to cross, they were fighting that storm from evening time until about 3 a.m. in the morning or 6 a.m. They thought that Christ was a nocturnal apparition, a ghost, or a demon in human form. One commentary says that there was a belief about a she-demon who would visit or appear at the night with a human face. And there were beliefs that demons were sighted among the seafaring men, and that such a sight was a warning of calamity to sailors. Some such frightful notions could have possessed the minds of the disciples. Christ speaks to them and tries to calm them. The commentary says, Peter knew his voice. He knew his voice, but he wasn't fully assured that it was Christ. And Peter might have considered that those apparitions were deceitful, and that Satan himself could transform himself into an angel of light and could put on the appearance of Christ himself. Mimic the voice of Christ and make appear to him. And Peter asked Christ, "If it's you, command me to come out to you." I don't know about you, brethren, but if I believed in seafaring apparitions, that would probably be the last question that I would ask. But Peter asked him, "If it's you, tell me to come out." And Peter did. Peter walked on the water. He actually walked on the water. Peter oftentimes gets criticized for having lack of faith. But he got out of the boat. Peter got out of the boat while the other 11 disciples stayed in the boat. With this in mind, brethren, I have a question for you. And it's the title of my sermon today. Would you have gotten out of the boat? Would you have gotten out of the boat? So who are these men, brethren, and why weren't they all willing to get out of the boat? When Christ chose these 12 men to be his disciples, his representatives, to preach the gospel and to carry his authority, he didn't choose one Pharisee. He didn't choose one Sadducee, one scribe, one rabbi, or one priest. Not one. Not one of the religious establishment. By choosing these men, Christ chose the men that he chose. Christ was making a major judgment against the testimony or the traditional Judaism of his day. Major judgment. It was a formal rejection of the men and their organizations of the religious establishment of that day, because they had become totally, totally corrupt. And the religious establishment considered him to be a threat to their power. And they hated him so much so that they wanted to kill him. Instead, he chose men who had no formal religious training whatsoever. He chose fishermen. He chose a tax collector. He chose a zealot. He chose craftsmen and other common men. Matthew 11, verse 1. Matthew 11, verse 1. Matthew 11, verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that he departed from there to teach and to preach in their cities." When these men were first called, they were referred to as disciples. They were disciples. The Greek word used here is mathetes, mathetes, which means learners, pupils, students. And that's what we are, brethren, disciples, students of Jesus Christ. And that is what they were doing for months, being taught and trained by Jesus Christ. Christ had many disciples, but only 12 were called and chosen for a unique office. Let's take a look at Luke 6. Luke 6. In Luke 6, beginning in verse 12. Luke 6, verse 12. It says, "Now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray, and he continued all night in prayer." He had a major decision to make. In verse 13 it says, "And when it was day, he called his disciples to him, and from them," there was multiples of disciples, "and from them he chose 12 whom he made, he also made apostles." As we saw before, Jesus oftentimes went out to the mountains to pray, especially when he had an important decision to make. Before he chose his 12 disciples, he prayed all night. And Luke says, Jesus had many students, many pupils, many disciples. And from those, or from them, he chose 12 men for a specific office, the office of apostle. Now, the Greek word used here is apostolos, apostolos. It means a delegate or an ambassador of the gospel. Officially, it's a commissioner of Christ with miraculous powers. He gave them miraculous powers. It also means messenger or he that is sent, he that is sent. It comes from the root word apostello, which means set apart. Set apart, or to send out on a mission. That's what their job was. They were given a unique office of authority and spokesmanship as ambassadors of Christ. But like Christ, they weren't respected by the religious establishment either. Let's turn to Acts 4, this time, Acts 4. See an example of this in Acts 4. Chapter 4 is where Peter and John were arrested by the members of the Sanhedrin. The context begins in chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, where Peter healed a lame man in the temple who was lame from birth, or lame in the womb, it says, in chapter 3, verse 2. Peter and John continued preaching. They talked to people, and they were preaching the gospel and teaching about the resurrection. Many were leaving Judaism and converting to Christianity. At this time, there was about 5,000 men. Now we pick it up in Acts 4, verse 1. It says, "Now as they spoke to the people," that's Peter and John, "the priests, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees came upon them, being greatly disturbed that they taught the people and preached in Jesus the resurrection from the dead." The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. That's why they were upset. "And they lay hands on them and put them in custody until the next day, for it was already evening. However, many of those who heard the word, they believed, and the number of the men that came to be about 5,000. 5,000 left Judaism for Christianity. In verse 5, "And it came to pass on the next day that their rulers, elders, and scribes, as well as Annas the high priest, Caiaphas, John, and Alexander, and many as were of the family of the high priest, were gathered together at Jerusalem. And when they had set them in the midst, they asked, 'By what power or what name have you done this?'" And skipping over to verse 13, it says, "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled." They marveled. "And they realized that they had been with Jesus. And seeing the man who had been healed standing with them, they could say nothing." Now, verse 6 mentions the office of high priest as Annas. At this time, the high priest was appointed by the Roman government. Annas had not been the high priest for about 18 years at this point in time. He was high priest from 6 AD to 15 AD. Caiaphas, his son-in-law, was the appointed and actual high priest, as we see in John 18, verse 13. The fact that Luke refers to Annas as high priest shows that he was a very powerful man. And he remained as one of the nation's most influential political and social leaders. And when Christ was arrested, they brought him to Annas first, even though he had no appointed position. Annas arranged to have five of his sons, one son-in-law, and one grandson appointed to the office of high priest. But he remained the real power behind that throne or office. That's how powerful Annas was. He used them as puppet priests. But he felt his power was threatened by Christ, so he conspired with Caiaphas to have him killed. It's interesting to note that there was a plot to kill Lazarus of Bethany after he was raised from the dead, which John records in John 12, verses 9 through 11. Jesus Christ gave the parable of the Lazarus and the rich man there. In the parable, the rich man had five brothers. Now, several 19th century writers believe that Annas was behind the plot to kill Lazarus because he was Jesus' friend, and because he, Annas, was convinced that Jesus was using him in that parable. He considered him to be the rich man. He thought he was talking about him. So he plotted to have Lazarus killed because he had five sons. And the parable says five brothers. Now, we don't know this for a fact, but another reason that he wanted to kill Lazarus for sure was, John says, because of his resurrection. Lazarus' resurrection, many more left Judaism and became Christians because of his resurrection. Now, going back to Acts 4:6, We see John and Alexander mentioned here in verse 6. They're unknown. But John, this person John, is thought to be Jonathan, one of Annas' son, the son who replaced or became the high priest, succeeded Caiaphas as high priest. And Alexander here is assumed to be a relative because there were so many family members there, it says. It was a big family deal. It was power. It was a powerhouse of family members. And these men wanted to know if Peter and John healed the lame man by some diabolical power, or some magic, or even by assistance from the devil. They told them that it was in the name of Jesus Christ, the one whom they crucified. In verse 13, these leaders were amazed at Peter and John's presence of mind, and not being afraid to profess the name of Christ and to actually charge them with his murder. They were amazed that they could even read and understand the scriptures and had never come from any formal training. Now, the word translated uneducated means illiterate. And the word translated untrained means ignoramus. So they thought them, they perceived the disciples to be illiterate ignoramuses. But back to the original question. Who are these 12 men in the boat with Jesus? Now, John MacArthur, in his book, 12 Ordinary Men, he divides them into three groups of four. The first four being Peter, Andrew, James, and John. The second group of four, he puts Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew. And the last group of four being James, the son of Alphaeus, also known as James the Less, Judas, the son of James, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot. Now, Peter is always listed first among the 12 when they're in the list of 12. Peter's always listed first. And he's always listed first in the group of four. Now, Peter, Andrew, James, and John probably knew each other. They knew each other quite well as fishermen. They seem to have been closer to Christ as well. John writes that these four were first called and would have been with him the longest. And of these four, Peter, James, and John, they formed an even more closer inner circle. Let's turn to Matthew 17. Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17 and verse 1. It says, now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, brought them up on a high mountain by themselves. In verse 2, he says, and was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Now Christ took these three with him to witness what is called the Transfiguration. And these three were with him on several other occasions as well, including the night that he was betrayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. He took Peter, James, and John. There were a lot of family members who knew Jesus and followed him as well. Luke 1:36 describes Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, as relatives. Now, the King James Version describes them as cousins. Given the ambiguity of the text, we cannot say for sure whether Jesus and John the Baptist were second cousins. But one thing for sure that we do know is that they were relatives, and they would have known each other. And going out further, and who may have been relatives, I'm going into the realm of speculation, brethren. Conjecture. Remember the S word, speculation. The context, brethren. What I want you to do is draw nine boxes on the page. like a tic-tac-toe, and then close it in. And then the first group across the page, I want you to put Mary Magdalene, Mary, mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. And let's turn to Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Matthew 27, verse 56. It says, "And many women who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons." That's what we wrote across the page. The context of these two scriptures is that at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, Matthew's account lists three women. Three women: Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and mother of the mother of Zebedee's sons. Now remember, the mother of Zebedee's sons was the mother of the apostles James and John. Mary Magdalene was the woman who Jesus removed seven demons from in Luke 8:2. And she became one of his most devoted followers. She was everywhere. She followed him everywhere. And there is evidence that Mary Magdalene had independent means. And she and other women helped provide for the needs of the disciples, their provisions. We see that in Luke 8:3. Now the name Mary Magdalene probably means that she came from the town of Magdala. It's a little fishing town that was on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, I want you to write across the next several boxes, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph. And then this box here, put Salome. Turn with me, if you would, brethren, to Mark's account of this in Mark 15, verse 40. Mark's account, verse 15 and verse 40. It says, "There were also women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James the Less, and Joseph, and Salome," or Salome. Now, Mark's account adds a little more information. He calls that Mary the mother of James the Less. But he lists Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James the Less, another apostle of Jesus Christ, and of Joseph, or Joseph, and Salome. Now, this would identify the mother of Zebedee's sons as Salome. Now, let's go to John's account, but before we do that, I want you to put Mary Magdalene, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and his mother's sister next. Let's turn to John 19. John 19, verse 25. John 19, verse 25 says, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus," John adds a woman, his mother, "and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene." You with me so far? John adds the words "his mother," meaning Jesus' mother Mary. Then John says "his mother's sister." Now, some Bible resources tell us that Jesus' mother's sister then was Salome, the wife of Zebedee and the mother of James and John. That would mean that Salome and Jesus was Jesus' aunt. Speculation. And the apostles James and John were then Jesus' cousins. Then John lists Mary, the wife of Clopas. And here it gets a little bit deeper. This is the same Mary, the mother of James the Less, and Joseph in the other accounts of Matthew and Mark. The second century historian Hegesippus, who wrote in 180 AD, he states that Clopas was the brother of Joseph the carpenter, Mary's husband and stepfather to Jesus. He also states that Clopas, Cleopas, and Alphaeus, they're all variations of the same name. This would mean that this Mary, the wife of Clopas, the same mother, or the same Mary, the mother of James and Joseph in Matthew and Mark's account, this would mean that that Mary, the wife of Clopas, would also be Jesus' aunt as well. And this would also make the apostle James the Less Jesus' cousin. And then John lists Mary Magdalene, as the other writers did, and if these things are true, it would mean that it'll mean something really different. The women who went to the tomb to prepare Jesus' body with spices were Mary Magdalene and his two aunts. Because Mark 16 says that now on the Sabbath was passed, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him. That would mean the mother of Zebedee's sons, James and John, the woman who asked Jesus if her sons could sit at his right hand and his left hand in the kingdom, was Jesus' aunt. Historian Hegesippus also says that the two disciples that was walking on the road to Emmaus, found in Luke 24, verse 13 through 35, Christ walked along the road with them. Do you remember the story? But they didn't know him. They didn't know who he was at first, but then he revealed himself. Hegesippus, he says that the disciple who was named Cleopas was the same as Clopas, the brother of Joseph the carpenter, Jesus' stepfather. And this would mean Jesus revealed himself to his uncle. Now, all these things, brethren, are they absolute facts beyond the shadow of a doubt? No. There's too much ambiguity in those scriptures. But it sometimes makes for interesting Bible study, for sure. But there are some things that we do know about the disciples that are factual, that we can pull from Scripture. So let's look at the first group of four, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. For instance, when we look at the Apostle Peter, we know that Peter was eager. He was aggressive and bold, outspoken and assertive, sometimes brass. Christ knew Peter before he called him. John 1:42 says that when Christ looked or called Peter, he looked at him and said, "You're Simon Bar-Jonah. I'm going to call you Simon Peter or Simon the Rock." He knew him. On whom he would build his church. We know that Simon had a home, that he was married because Christ healed his mother-in-law of fever. We see that in Luke 4:38. In Luke 5:3, describing the fishing business, it mentions one of the boats we just read about before. One of the boats which was Simon's. In Luke 5:10, Luke says that James and John were partners with Simon. They all knew each other. And Simon Peter was a fisherman by trade. He and his brother Andrew were heirs to a family business, fishing business, which was centered around Capernaum. It's interesting to note that the Sea of Galilee was rich in fish at the time of Christ. Various sources claim that in Jesus' time, there were about 37 different varieties of fish that were caught there. Today, there's about 18 species of indigenous fish in the Sea of Galilee. The edible fishes, or edible, I guess I could say edible fishes because it was different kinds. The edible fishes are divided into three groups. The first is the Kinneret sardine. Kinneret sardine. John 6 says, or John 6, 9 talks about the boy. Remember with the five loaves and two small fish. It was probably those sardine, the Kinneret sardine. In New Testament times, these fish were processed for pickling. The small town of Magdala was known as the center of this fishing industry. That's how Mary Magdalene came in. That's where she probably was from, Mary Magdalene, because of Magdala. The second type of fish is called the biny, B-I-N-Y, or barbels. This group consists of three species of the carp family. They can weigh as much as 15 pounds. The third type of fish is called the mushed, M-U-S-H-T, mushed. This group includes the most popular tilapia Galilea. It's commonly known as St. Peter's fish. And just a side note, in 2005, 295 tons of St. Peter's fish were caught annually. But in 2009, the total dropped to about 8 tons. Tremendous drop. They were depleting the Sea of Galilee. In 2010, fishing was actually banned from the Sea of Galilee for 2 years. This was the first time in 5,000 years the Sea of Galilee did not provide fish for the local population. And in 2013, 1 million healthy tilapia were released into the sea to try to revive the sea, to revive that species. But back to Peter, or Simon Peter. We know that Simon and Andrew are originally from a small village, Bethsaida, which was located on the north shore of the lake. John 1:44 tells us that. But later they moved to a larger town located nearby called Capernaum. Mark 1:29-21 says that. We know that Peter was the leader of the apostles. Let's turn to Matthew 10. Matthew 10, verse 2. Matthew 10, verse 2. It says, now the names of the 12 apostles are these. And then it says, first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. Now, the word that Matthew uses here for first is protos, P-R-O-T-O-S, protos, which means foremost, or the chief, as in the leader of the group. He was the leader of the 12 and also the leader of the first four. Peter normally acts as spokesman for the entire group. Peter's name is mentioned in the Gospels more than any other except for Jesus Christ. No one is spoken to by Christ as often as Peter was. Now, Peter died a martyr, and tradition has it that he was crucified upside down because he didn't feel worthy to be crucified the same way as Jesus. The second disciple is Andrew. Andrew is a Greek name for Andreas. Andrew was a disciple of John the Baptist. John 1, verse 35 through 42 tells us that. And he was the first disciple of the group, and the entire group to be called by Christ. He was a fisherman by trade as well. He lived with his brother Peter in this house in Capernaum, Mark 1:29. He was responsible for introducing his brother Peter to Christ. That's John 1:40, 41 and 42. Like Peter, he was originally from Bethsaida. Andrew was the kind of person who seldom came to the forefront. His personality was totally opposite of his brother Peter. Andrew's name appears in the New Testament only 9 times. And most of those times It's always followed by, or most often followed by, he was Peter's brother, or the brother of Peter. He lived his life in the shadow of his more dominant and better known brother, Peter. The Bible does not record what happened to Andrew after Pentecost, but tradition says that he took the gospel north. Eusebius, the ancient historian, says Andrew went as far south as Scythia, up to where Russia is today. It says he was crucified, but on an X-shaped type cross. The next apostle is James. James is the brother of John and the son of Zebedee and Salome. He was a fisherman as well. He is sometimes referred to as James the Greater or James the Great. Not because he was great, because he probably was older. And he might have been taller. And that's to distinguish him from James the Less. Little is known about James, but it is obvious that he was a man of intense fervor and intensity. How do we know that? Because James had a fiery, vehement disposition, while Andrew had a quiet disposition, wanting to bring people to Christ. He brought Peter. James was wishing that he could call down fire from heaven and destroy whole villages of people. Luke 9:51-56 mentions this, that showing James and John had thunderous personalities, causing Christ to nickname them Boanerges, or sons of thunder. They had thunderous personalities. Mark 3:17 says that. More than likely, James preached the gospel up into Spain and Portugal, tradition says. James would become the first of the 12 to be killed for his faith. And that is recorded in Acts 12, verse 1 and 2. He was killed by sword, meaning he was probably beheaded. Next is the Apostle John. John was the brother of James and the son of Zebedee and Salome, too. He was a fisherman by trade as well, which meant he was rugged and hard-edged, just like the rest of the fishermen. It was hard work. They weren't little mealy-mouthed guys. They were tough men. He had a temperament just like his brother James, wanting to call down fire from heaven to consume the Samaritans who had rejected Christ. He wrote the book of John, the books 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and he also wrote the book of Revelation. As mentioned before, John was arrested with Peter because he was a frequent companion to Peter, as recorded in the first 12 chapters of the book of Acts. As much as Peter was in the foreground, John remained in the background. John was just like his older brother James in zeal and ambition, but later learned the quality of love from Jesus Christ himself. He wrote more about the importance of love than any other New Testament writer. And because of that, he is often referred to as the apostle of love. John was a disciple of John the Baptist, and he was called by Jesus with Andrew. It says that in John 1, the other disciple is said to be John. Now, John was the only disciple who did not suffer martyrdom. He was banished to a prison community on the Isle of Patmos. He outlived the other disciples and was the only one to die of natural causes. And the next group of four I'd like to cover, the next group of four is Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew. Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew. Now, Philip is always listed first in this second group of four, which means he may have been the leader of that group. Philip is the Greek name meaning lover of horses. The Greek form of his name is Philippos with an F. Now, all of the apostles were Jewish, so he must have had a Jewish name, but is never given. John 1:44 says that he was from Bethsaida as well, the city of Andrew and John, or Andrew and Peter. He probably grew up attending the same synagogue as Peter and Andrew. It was a small community, and they were Jews. He is considered to be one of the unnamed disciples in John 21:2 who went back to fishing after Christ's resurrection. So he probably was a fisherman like Peter. And he brought Nathanael. He brought Nathanael, his friend, to Christ. Philip appears to be a facts and figures man. He appears to be a facts and figures man, but he was somewhat pessimistic. Christ knew this about Philip, and he tested him with a question, as recorded in John 6, verse 7. He asked Philip, "How can we feed so many people?" He already knew the answer. It was about 5,000 people. Christ already knew the answer, but he knew that Philip was a facts and figures man. He probably was the administrator of the group setting up how to feed the people. And Philip answered somewhat pessimistically. He said, "We can't feed this many people with 200 denarii. He probably knew what was in the money box. But Christ knew how he was going to do that. He was testing. He was testing Philip. Now, tradition has it that Philip preached in Greece, Syria, and Phrygia, which is Turkey today. And by most accounts, he was put to death by crucifixion as well. The next disciple is Bartholomew. Bartholomew. It's interesting to note that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, never mention the name Nathanael. They always refer to him as Bartholomew. But John, on the other hand, he never mentions the name Bartholomew. He always refers to him as Nathanael. Bartholomew is a Hebrew surname meaning the son of Tolmai. T-O-L-M-A-I. The son of Tolmai. John uses his real name while the others use his surname of son of Tolmai. So his full name is Nathanael Bar Tolmai or Nathanael Bartholomew. Nathanael, the son of Tolmai. He was Philip's friend. He was Philip's friend. John 21:2 says that he came from the small town of Cana. Cana is the place where Jesus performed that first miracle. Remember when he turned the water into wine? It was in the town of Cana. And Cana was very close to Nazareth, Jesus' hometown. It was only about 3.5 miles away. Let's turn to John 1. In John 1. John 1, verse 43. John 1, verse 43 says, "The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip." This was the second day after he called Andrew and Peter. In verse 44, he says, "Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.' And Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?' Philip said to him, 'Come and see.' And in verse 47, Jesus said, saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, 'Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile.'" I don't know if that sounds a little sarcastic to me, because he knew what he was thinking. "Nathanael said to him, 'How do you know me?' Jesus answered him and said to him, 'Before Philip called you, when you were under that fig tree, I saw you.'" And that's where Nathanael was. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And the verses 45 shows us that Nathanael and Philip were students of the Old Testament scriptures. The verse 46 shows Nathanael's prejudice. He was a very prejudiced individual. It was inconceivable to him that the Messiah could come from a place like Nazareth. It was uncultured. It was an uncultured place, full of evil, corrupt, and full of contemptible people. He was blind to the very fact that his town, the little town of Cana, where he came from, was much the same. But he believed when Christ told him where he was early in the day. He believed. And we see in verse 48, he told him he saw him under the fig tree. Now, early church records suggest that Nathanael ministered in Persia, India, and Armenia. Tradition says that he was crucified upside down like Peter. Next in line is the apostle Matthew. Mark 2, verse 14 refers to him as Levi, the son of Alphaeus. Could this be the same Alphaeus as James the Less's father? We don't know. Could his family have disowned him as a Jew? You see, Matthew was a publican, a tax collector in Capernaum. You see that in Matthew 2, verse 1 and 14. They were the most despised people in Israel. And as a tax collector, he would have been forbidden to enter any synagogue. Matthew was a humble man, though, who stayed in the background. He wrote the Gospel of Matthew. We know that Matthew was very familiar with the Old Testament scriptures because he quotes them 99 times in his book. He believed in God and he looked for the Messiah. Matthew wrote his gospel with a Jewish audience in mind. And tradition says that he ministered to the Jews in Israel and abroad for many years before he was martyred as well. And early tradition says that he was burned at the stake. The next apostle is Thomas. The apostle Thomas. John 11:16 says, or John says that he was called Didymus. He was called Didymus. Didymus is the Greek name for Thomas. They both mean twin. So possibly Thomas may have had a twin, but his twin, if he did, is never mentioned in Scripture. He's also known as Doubting Thomas because he wouldn't believe the rest of the disciples when they said they saw Christ after he was resurrected. He said he wouldn't believe that until he was able to put his hands and his fingers in his wounds before he would believe that Jesus was resurrected. Thomas was just as much a pessimist, though, as he was a doubter. Let's turn to John 11. John 11. The context here begins in chapter 10 and verse 40. It says they were in the wilderness, that Jesus and them were in the wilderness where John had been. John the Baptist, that is. And Jesus gets word that his friend Lazarus is sick in John 11:6. Christ waits there two more days, and he tells them, we have to go back to Judea. His disciples think that he's crazy because the Jews there wanted to kill him. They wanted to stone him. He finally tells them that Lazarus is dead, and they now know they have to go back. In verse 16, it says, this is where Thomas speaks up, the pessimist Thomas. I'm accused of that all the time. That'll never work. I must have been named after him for a reason. But Thomas says, let's go. Everything will be fine. It'll all work out. The Lord knows what he's doing. We'll all be fine. Right? No. Thomas said, let's go. He's going to die, so we're all dying. We're going to die with him. He was pessimistic. He was very pessimistic. But even though he was pessimistic, he was very, very loyal to Jesus Christ. The tradition says that he carried the gospel as far as India. And he was killed and martyred by being killed with a spear. The first of the next group is James, the Apostle James, or the son Alphaeus, also known as James the Less. James's nickname was Mikros, which means little, the minor, or the younger. When I was a boy growing up, I had an uncle Tommy, and he had a son named Tommy, and my name was Tommy. I was known as Marion's Tommy. My cousin was known as Little Tommy, and my uncle was known as Big Tommy. That's what this means here. James, Little James, Little James. Could also mean his stature, that he was small. He may have been small. It could mean that he was younger than Zebedee's son James. James was quiet. This James was quiet. He stayed in the background as well. Since he was the son of Alphaeus, the same name as Matthew's father, some have speculated that he and Matthew may have been brothers. But Matthew and James are nowhere in the Bible are identified in Scripture as brothers. Speculation. There's just not enough information to prove that one way or the other. Now, there is some evidence that James the Less took the gospel to Syria and to Persia. Most accounts say that he was stoned to death as well. Next apostle is Simon the Zealot. This is the man I want to ask Christ about. Simon the Zealot. Why did he call Simon? You might understand after I give you this information. Matthew and Mark refer to him as Simon the Canaanite. That's Matthew 10:4 and Mark 3:18. It's not a reference to the land or the people or that he was from Cana. The name or the word that Matthew and Mark use is, it means zealous, Canaanite, zealous. Simon belonged to a political group called the Zealots. They were the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the Zealots. They hated the Romans, and they wanted to overthrow Roman occupation. They advanced their agenda primarily through terrorism. They were terrorists. Through acts of violence. They carried a dagger with them in their cloak. They were known as political assassins. And they would take out a Roman soldier or someone that they perceived to be a political enemy, such as a tax collector, they would kill him. Jesus put those two together. Tax collector and a zealot. It's amazing that Jesus called a man like Simon the Zealot to be an apostle. But he was a man of strong loyalties, very strong loyalties. He had great passion, amazing courage, and tremendous zeal. That's why he's called the Zealot. He believed the truth and he embraced it. Now, some accounts say that after the destruction of Jerusalem, he took the gospel north and he preached in the British Isles and was also killed for preaching the gospel. Next is Judas, son of James. Judas, son of James. Matthew 10, verse 3, he is called Labius, whose surname was Thaddeus. Judas was probably the name that was given to him at birth. Labius and Thaddeus are essentially nicknames, and both nicknames mean heart or heart child. Both names suggest that he had a tender, childlike heart. He was compassionate and gentle. He's only mentioned once in the New Testament in John 14, verse 22. He asked Christ the question, "Why are you manifesting yourself to us? Why not take it to the whole world?"
That's what he wanted. He wanted to share everything with the whole world. And by the way, he phrased the question, we see that he was tender-hearted, full of humility. He wasn't bold and brash like Peter with his question to Christ. He was known to have taken the gospel into Mesopotamia, where the region of Turkey is today. Tradition says that he was clubbed to death for his faith. The last one is Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot, every time he's mentioned in Scripture, a reference to him being a traitor is made. The one who betrayed Christ, or a traitor. His name means Judas, man of Kerioth. Kerioth was a town in the south of Judea, which means he may have been the only apostle that was not or did not come from Galilee. John 12:6 tells us that he was the treasurer of the group. John 6:71 says his father's name was Simon. Judas let bitterness begin to eat away at him. After collecting the money, 30 pieces of silver, and conspiring with the priest, he came to Passover. He came to Passover services, showing that he was a hypocrite. Luke 22:6 says that he had been waiting for an opportunity to betray him in the absence of the multitude, showing that he was a coward as well. He was remorseful, but he was unrepentant for what he had done. Then he went out and he hung himself. Now we know that in the book of Acts, Matthias was chosen by lots to replace him. Acts 1:22 says that Matthias was there from the beginning when Jesus Christ was baptized. So he was a disciple of John too, John the Baptist. Now each of these men had a unique personality. Christ picked common, working class, ordinary people just like you and just like me. But he transformed them into some of the most powerful people the world has ever seen. So why didn't the 11 get out of the boat with Peter? And what caused Peter to sink? I have a few reasons I want to go through real quickly here, brethren. Number one is they all had fear. They all had fear. Because of the seafaring tales they had heard, they were afraid. And add to the fact that it was dark, and they were in the middle of a storm. They were fearful. Matthew 14. We already read this, I think. Matthew 14 and verse 27. Matthew 14, verse 27 says, "But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid.'" Skipping down to verse 30, he says, "But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid," talking about Peter, "and he began to sink. He cried out, 'Lord, save me.'" Christ knew that they had fear, and Peter sank because he had fear as well. Secondly, they had doubt. Verse 31 here says, "Immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and he caught him. And he said to him, 'Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" Why did you doubt? Even though Jesus assured them that it was he, and he was not a ghost walking on the water, walking toward them, they still had doubts in their mind. The 11 didn't get out of the boat and Peter sank because of doubt. Thirdly, they lacked faith. They lacked faith. We just read Christ told them, "You doubted because you lacked faith." Four times in the book of Matthew alone, Christ says to them, "O you of little faith." Number four is they lacked humility, the right kind of humility. They were self-absorbed, self-centered, and proud. They spent a lot of time arguing amongst themselves who would be the greatest in the kingdom. Number five is they lack commitment. They lacked commitment. Jesus gave them the extraordinary gifts of power. They saw his miracles. They were with him, heard his sermons. They saw everything. But when the soldiers came, it says they all forsook him and fled. They all forsook him and fled. No commitment. In John 21:3, after Christ's resurrection and his appearing to them, he appeared to the disciples several times. What did Peter say? The leader of the group, the leader of all of them, he said, I'm going fishing. And six others said, I'm going with you. They lacked commitment. Number six, they felt comfortable in the boat. They felt comfortable in the boat. That was their safe zone. They felt safe in the boat. That was their comfort zone. When the storms of life, brethren, come our way, are we afraid to get out of the boat? Our comfort zone may be many things. Work. Feel comfortable where we are in our work. We don't want a promotion. We don't want to go ahead because our comfort zone is here. Maybe sometimes something happens like that in school. Maybe responsibility here at church. Oh, I can't do opening prayer. Nope. Where's your comfort zone? We know that, as we discussed before, another comfort zone of the disciples was fishing. I'm going fishing. And final point, brethren, number seven, is they lacked God's Spirit. They lacked God's Spirit. They lacked the power to overcome their human weaknesses. They lacked the power to get out of the boat. We know they received that power on the day of Pentecost, don't we? When we look at the men that God called, brethren, we might wonder, with all of their weaknesses, why would God single out men who were fearful, men who doubted, who lacked faith, who lacked humility? They were not committed. They wouldn't leave their comfort zone, and they had no power of their own. Why would he call those people? The answer is found in 1 Corinthians. One final scripture. 1 Corinthians. Scripture familiar to all of us, brethren. 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 1. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27. It says, but God has chosen the foolish of the world, the foolish things of the world, to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen. And the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. No one could ever examine this group of men and conclude that what they accomplished was because of their own natural abilities. They had nothing to do with it. There is no human explanation for the influence the apostles had on the world. All the glory goes to God. All the glory goes to God. With these things in mind, brethren, if the situation presented itself today with you in the boat, and most importantly, based on your relationship with God now, would you get out of the boat?